public hearing on House Bill 2051. We apologize to the folks who were here on Friday that we ran out of time, so we wanted to start this meeting with the public hearing. And Kat, can you just remind us about the bill for those folks who are not here, and then I will start calling up witnesses.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. House Bill 2051 extends from 5 to 7 years the schedule for Metro to complete an inventory, determination, and analysis of housing capacity and need within the urban growth boundary.
Okay. Thank you. Colleagues, we have some handouts in your folder from that Metro handed out. We heard only from Metro some introductory comments, and we were not able to hear the other witnesses, so I'm going to call up folks, and then we'll probably have Metro come back up to walk through some of the handouts that I had some questions about. So first, okay, we have nobody from out of town, although Washington County is sort of far out there. Okay.
In miles or?
What are you talking about?
It's almost 50. It's almost So I will actually ask Dennis, is he here? I see Dennis yet? Okay. Jack Isselman from the city, representing the city of Hillsborough, wanted to come up. And then I will just start at the top. I'm going to ask, since we have a whole page of folks who'd like to come up, if all of you would come up at the same time and just make it a little bit faster. Greg Miller from AGC. Is Greg here? And Scott Ashram. I know Scott's here. This is not a meaning that you're all associated or affiliated in any way, but just for the record, if you can state your name.
Quite all right. Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, my name is Jack Isselman of Tonkin Torp. I'm here today representing the city of Hillsborough. I am delivering testimony on behalf of our mayor, Tom Hughes, who is out of state today on a family emergency. And copies of the testimony are being circulated to the committee. Briefly, the city of Hillsborough supports this bill, House Bill 2015, for the following reasons. We believe the two-year delay the determination of the Metro UGB is necessary for three reasons. The first is it will allow time for Oregon's Land Conservation and Development Commission to prepare and adopt a goal and rules by the end of 2007 for establishment in 2008 in collaboration with Metro to determine rural reserves, areas outside the UGB that would become no-touch agriculture for the next 40 to 50 years. We also support the bill because it would allow Metro sufficient time to apply their great communities principles, and representatives of Metro can speak more directly to what those principles entail. But it would allow the establishment of 40 to 50 year urban reserves from the land pool from which future Metro UGB expansions would be made exclusively. Metro and the counties would work collaboratively to establish rural reserves and urban reserves in accordance with LCDC goals and rules. This bill is joined by two companion pieces, Legislative Concept 3289, which allows the process to proceed on urban and rural reserves, and a bill that the city of Hillsborough has negotiated with Metro, and we are bringing forward together LC 2474, that relates to regional land use planning and how local rules intersect with the comprehensive planning of the Metro Regional Council. So with that, I will conclude my testimony, and I'm available for any questions the committee may have.
Okay. Thank you, Jack. And I just want to let you know the bill number on the sheet is actually backwards. It's 2051. So
I'm sorry. Yeah.
For the record.
I had that wrong in mind. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Greg Miller. I'm here representing Associated General Contractors in support of House Bill 2051. AGC has worked with Metro in the past, specifically in the last year, in coming up with a mechanism to fund the comprehensive planning of approximately 6,000 acres in the metro region that there was just no money for. Metro came to Associated General Contractors as well as some other interested parties to come up with this mechanism, and we supported the construction excise tax, which has been approved, and actually money has been doled out for that planning. AGC supports this extension of the review of the urban growth boundary lands because it will give Metro some additional time to look at coming up with a permanent funding source for infrastructure for these expansion lands. It's a very important issue for us as lands aren't, they're just not developable without having the roads, sewers, school systems in place to support the land that's been brought into the urban growth boundary. So that issue coupled with looking at urban reserves and how to establish where that region grows in the future is important to myself and my members. So we're supportive and be happy to answer your questions.
Okay, thank you. Scott?
Scott Ashcombe with the Oregon Agricultural Alliance. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I just would like to express our organization's support for House Bill 2051. We were involved in the drafting of the original process for expansion of urban growth boundaries. I call them Goal 14 areas. And we tried our best in the process of writing those rules and earlier than that, the implementing statutes, to make it as close to impossible as we possibly could to expand an urban growth boundary, because you know that converts farmland to urbanizable land, oftentimes residential land. And of course, we'd like to keep as much farmland and farm use as we possibly can. So we would support moving that deadline back from 5 to 7, or for that matter, from 7 to 11, or from 11 to 100. We're in support of the bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there any questions for this panel? Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. All right. Let's see. Jonathan Schloeder. I've got to make sure I say your name right. And Jim McCauley and Harlan Levy. I don't see Harlan here. Okay, so why don't we have, is John Schellenberg here?
Okay. Madam Chair?
Yep. All right, so you guys are up.
With chair's indulgence, I'm going to join Mr. McCauley.
Okay. We get to see you twice on this, huh?
No, just the once.
Oh, okay. Oh, that's right, that was the UIC. Solid blur. All right, thank you.
Madam Chair, Dingfelder, my name is Jonathan Schloeder, the Executive Director of Westside Economic Alliance. We're a business advocacy group representing the employers, the business developers, land developers, and commercial property managers on the west side of the Portland metro region, as well as some of the communities represented in Washington County and portions of Clackamas County that stride I-5 between Lake Oswego down through Tualatin to Wilsonville. I signed up to testify in opposition to this bill, but even that indication has been misinterpreted as to our feelings on this piece of legislation. I'd like to be very clear for the record and in our testimony for the committee's consideration today, in that we listened very carefully to the testimony offered by Metro and by the previous witnesses Friday and again this afternoon, and in the questions that Representative Cannon directed to the Metro Council representatives on Friday. We would not disagree with any of the premises that were offered for support of 2051. All of the issues that were discussed, that a five-year periodic review wastes money, that it discourages redevelopment of brownfield areas within the urban growth boundary, that it takes time, talent, and resources away from the development of areas that were added to the urban growth boundary in 2002 and 2004 are entirely valid, and that more money is needed to actually bring infrastructure to the areas that have been added to the urban growth boundary in 2002 and 2004 are entirely valid. Our concerns are simply that this bill doesn't do it. This bill doesn't get to the end line that the Metro Council and that the business community and that the communities encompassed by the Metro jurisdictions say they want to get to. This doesn't provide the mechanism that they are seeking. We were concerned as an organization that Metro set a low bar for adding residential and industrial lands to the urban growth boundary in 2002 and again in 2004. In 2005, Metro acknowledged that the population estimates for the Metro region were low, that 300,000 people had been added to the regional population in the previous 10 years, and that that would require some land use adjustments to the area. But then they failed to achieve even the low bar estimates for land needs that they had set for themselves in 2002 and 2004, did not add the lands needed and in areas that could reasonably be expected to be developed and by jurisdictions that could serve them around the metro area. At the end of the day, we are left with critical shortages of both residential and industrial properties on the west side. Some of that is addressed in the handout that I provided for you here, that we are supposed to have a 20-year land supply for industrial development on the Portland metro region. 46% of the shovel-ready sites identified by the state of Oregon in the Portland metro area are already under active development or contract. How 2-year delay in this process is going to achieve the end result of developing those lands is subject to considerable question. So the point of all of this is simply to conclude that House Bill 2051 has considerable merit and worth your consideration and discussion. But there is additional issues to be addressed here in the definition of where the urban reserves should be and where the agricultural preserves should be addressed, as well as Senate Bill 186, Lane Cheddarly and the Department of Land Conservation and Development's address of industrial reserves around the Portland metro region and across the state, because we are critically short of industrial areas in the state that are developable and available for employers moving here or existing employers wanting to expand here. We would ask that this be considered as a broader package in the context of those other bills. And once we have those issues in front of you for your consideration and discussion, we've got more to talk about, and we can come back and have that conversation. Thank you very much for your consideration.
Thank you. Jim?
Yeah. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jim McCauley, representing Portland Metro Home Builders Association. Our membership is inclusive within a 5-county region, Clackamas, Washington, Multnomah, Columbia, as well as Yamhill counties. We have a membership base of nearly 1,500 members representing builders, developers, and a range of associate members that contribute within the home building industry. Based on a considerable amount of interaction that we've had with Metro over the last several weeks as well as months, our membership has been unable to get to a point where we can support 2051 at this point in time, as well as any other effort to lengthen the urban growth boundary process, unless there is a short-term land supply issue addressed. HBA is not opposing any other elements of Metro's legislative package at this point in time. In fact, we're going to be very supportive of a rural urban legislative item once that is finalized, as well as the possibility of an infrastructure finance package. I think I'll echo similar to what Jonathan said. The most important item for us at this point in time are some of the other policy issues that are out there right now that can assist with infrastructure finance and provide some mechanisms that will provide a funding component for infrastructure needs for lands that are currently in the UGB as well as others that are perhaps on the docket for coming in the future. At this point in time, we have very limited options out there for dealing with this infrastructure finance, and we need to be looking at those as a priority for this legislative session and potentially others in the future. We clearly need an improvement in our land use system, but our members are not confident that an additional 2 years tacked on to the expansion process is going to get us to that point. We believe the 2 years coupled with addressing a short-term land supply would be a better method to move forward on. A couple of items that I included in my testimony. One was reference to a 2001 letter that HBA had written in response to Metro's change in a code ordinance, and this gets to kind of the short-term land supply issue. At that point in time, jurisdictions and landowners had the opportunity to petition or essentially ask Metro Council to bring lands in outside the urban growth boundary process. So in between that 5-year schedule, they had that opportunity. But in 2002, Metro Council decided to eliminate that option, not for all of the different land uses, but just for residential. So the industrial as well as commercial interests still have that opportunity at this time, or have had it since 2002, and residential has been essentially pulled out of that equation at this point in time. And we're going to be working with Metro to see if there's a possibility of revisiting that code language here in the near future. The other point I wanted to at least offer was in reference to affordable housing. We had a report that was commissioned by Portland State University, their College of Urban and Public Affairs in 2006, and this essentially was a land value trend analysis. Their work confirmed most of our observations that were out there, and that is we've had an accelerated increase in land values over the last 4 to 5 years, so much so that it's outpaced not only the housing market in terms of those trends, but it's been well above some of the other estimates that are out there. And the report itself doesn't make a conclusion that it's exclusive or that it's pointing specifically a constrained land use system in our region, but it is certainly one of the contributing factors. So from this point forward for us, we're going to continue to work with Metro and hopefully be able to find some short-term land supply, and I'll be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. John, did you want to add anything?
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. John Chandler for the Oregon Home Builder Association. Mr. McCauley's organization is one of our 13 local associations. I'm here both in support of the Portland position, but also as the individual who's at whose behest the five-year period is put in the statute in the first place. There's nothing magic about 5 years as a review cycle. Five could have been seven, it could have been 11, it could have been 16 and a half weeks. The point was, at that time when we passed the law back in 2001, to set up a system for Metro to adopt that would have them looking at their urban growth needs in a systemic fashion and just have that process ongoing. As you all know, under Oregon's land use system, we have to have a 20-year supply of land. And one of the things I think hit all of us, certainly hit me, I think it hit the folks at Metro as well, was we spent so much time in arguing about 20-year land supply back when we were doing that in the mid-90s, and when urban growth boundaries are being examined, we spend an awful lot of time and energy litigating and arguing with each other over years 15 to 20, the out years. We don't spend enough time, we didn't spend enough time looking at the short term. The 0 to 5, what happens today of governmental action, private action, that can actually result in land coming online, being developed, sprouting houses, sprouting stores, creating jobs, all the things it's supposed to do. What happens 15 years out is important, but it's not as critical. And the position we're taking today, I think, is aimed at that short-term land supply. I absolutely understand Metro's concern in wanting to get off of the five-year cycle. Don't necessarily disagree with that concern. What I do disagree with, and I think the point we're trying to make, is there's got to be a way, as we're looking at extending that review period from 5 to 7, to also make sure that the short-term needs are addressed so they don't get the price run-ups that we've seen, so they are actually bringing land online for development. Most of the urban growth boundary expansion that happened in the Portland metro area has had nothing happen to it. And there's all sorts of reasons for that. It's not a metro problem. It's an us problem. We didn't think about infrastructure. We didn't think about roads. We didn't think about water and sewer. We didn't even think about how to do the land use planning necessary to think about water, sewer, and infrastructure. We believe that there are things that Metro could do, and we've been talking with them, we'll continue to talk to them, that will help alleviate some of the short-term supply, if only by a simple code change on their part, to allow residential development to ask if they can be included while we're letting the planning process run. Would not prejudge any outcome on the part of Metro. They could still say no, have every confidence that they can do that. I've seen them do it. I think that would be a hopeful for my membership, certainly, that our concern about short-term wasn't getting lost in some of these other conversations. As far as the other parts of the Metro package, we are absolutely in support, at least in concept. We haven't seen the language on all of them, but the infrastructure funding piece that they're working on, we've been part of those conversations. We anticipate continuing to be so. The urban and rural reserves, we think, are critical to getting our hands around the land supply issue in the metro area. It's just this one piece, and even more specifically, the part we think is missing out of this one piece in terms of addressing short-term supply that causes us concern, and we want to call to your attention. We remain supportive of both the system, sometimes a loyal opposition, but still supportive of land use planning in Oregon, and specifically in the metro area. We would ask you to, we cannot support this bill as is written at this point. I'll be glad to take any questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions for this panel? Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate all of your willingness, not only to come here and testify, but to work with Metro on this whole series of policy changes that it sounds like Metro and you agree need to take place going forward. And you've mentioned a bunch of them here today. But we're the bill in front of us, 2051, is concerned with only one word, and that word is seven, changing that five-year review to seven-year review. And based on the fact that, you know, we've heard there, Metro's brought in 20,000 acres of new land into the UGB over the last 5 years, and very little, practically none of it, has been developed, it's very hard for me to see how we, what good would come from undergoing this process again. And I guess I'm wondering what makes you think if we brought in more land now that it would be, that we'd take care of any of these sort of underlying needs. I mean, I understand that there are those underlying needs about bringing the infrastructure, finding the permanent funding mechanism, et cetera. And I hope that we have a chance in this committee to hear on how we're going to do that or assist local government in doing that. But I when we look at this bill, this particular bill, what can you say that can tell me that if we take this process now, if we go with the 5 years, if we stay with 5 years, that it's going to solve any of these problems?
You want to take it first?
And I'm going to have to ask you gentlemen to be brief because we have several people that still want to testify. Again.
In response, Representative Cannon, only a small portion of the 20,000 acres was industrial land to which I can speak, but those industrial acres were often chosen in areas that, let me just say, were politically expedient more than economically efficient or accessible to the jurisdictions that would extend the infrastructure to actually get out there and serve them. That is a very difficult process, to be sure. There are areas of our region that are accessible and serviceable by the jurisdictions, but the broader concern and issue to be addressed by this legislature is going to be the urban ag land conflict of developing into prime agricultural lands, because frankly on the west side of the Portland metro region, much of what is designated or defined as prime agricultural land is also the areas best suited to industrial and residential development, and that's going to be very, very difficult for this legislature to deal with. Just redrawing the map is not the answer, that's to be sure, but 2051 in our view is nibbling at the edges of a much bigger problem.
Yeah, real quick, Madam Chair, Representative Cannon, a couple of things. One is the history with the lands that have been brought in and the difficulty of trying to get those into a planning stage really falls on local governments. And that has been a very difficult point with our membership because they essentially are given 2 years once those lands are brought in. And quite frankly, very few of those local jurisdictions throughout the metro region have actually fallen in place or in line with what they're supposed to be doing. And that's part of what's prompted the excise tax last year and why we supported it. So there's a physical planning fund out there right now to deal with that backlog, a very significant backlog. Now, I think as we go forward, 2 years may not seem like much, but it does disrupt part of that cycle and part of the process of lands coming physically into the system. If we had a system that functioned better and that had a better structure to it, and we could actually see the light at the end of the tunnel once these lands were brought in, I think we'd probably have a little bit more confidence. So that's why I think you hear what our members are saying, at least at this point in time, is that we need to be able to address some of those short-term land supply needs, which do physically exist out there. We have jurisdictions, and we do have landowners out there willing to bring lands in cases that are accessible and things of that nature, and that would meet those short-term things. But in terms of the long-term, we clearly need to come up with a better system. I think all of us are on point on that and totally understand it. And it's just a matter of that two-year period represents just part of the disruption.
Madam Chair, if I might, too very briefly, Representative Cannon, I'd like to respond to what I think I heard implicit in your question. It's not simply a two-year extension. It turns into about a four-year extension by the time the local work is done. The Metro has a period of time after they identify the lands to do their work, then the local governments have to do the planning. And our concern, the reason we put 5 years in the statute to begin with, we're not opposing this just to have a tantrum. We're opposing it because we believe this process needs to be kept on a pretty firm timeline. Otherwise, it will drift. It has drifted. It did drift before we came in. We have a good relationship with Metro. We're not mad at them. But it isn't as simple as saying, well, we're just going to add another couple of years, because the implications on the ground of even a two-year delay, never mind a four- or five-year delay by the time the work gets done, can be many thousands of dollars in the purchase price of a home, if it's even able to be built at all, and further takes the pressure off, if you will. Some of the harder conversations have to occur about the ag land base and the infrastructure needs and so on. I understand it's only a two-word change, but the implications on the ground can be pretty substantial.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. Is Terry Wheeler here? Is it Wheeler?
Whistler.
Okay. Terry from the city of Cornelius. And then Art Schlack. I haven't seen Art. I did see Dennis come in. Dennis, if you want to come up, sit with your city. And I think also I saw Carlin come in. Oh, okay. I saw Harlan limp in. Okay. Would you like to limp up here? We can get started while he's doing that. Go ahead.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, I'm glad I was next to be able to play off of the comments you've just heard. City of Cornelius, you may not be familiar with. We're fairly small at the very western edge of the urban boundary, tight against Forest Grove.
And can you say your name for the record,
please? I'm sorry. Terry Whistler, City of Cornelius.
Thank you.
We're about 11,000. We're one of those communities that are ready to expand both with residential and manufacturing properties. We had relied upon the schedule established for those expansions and don't really oppose this bill. We do agree there are underlying issues that need to be resolved. There's a lot of work that's floating around and is difficult. But we're kind of like the ants hoping we don't get stepped on as those titans struggle, because we're running out of space. We've just lost one of our industries. Nut and Berry Packer was looking to go to a 20-acre expansion. They could not assemble more than one 20-acre parcel within the community. And since that was only one, the monopoly pressure, they couldn't pay that price. They had to leave. So not only did we lose the expansion of the employment, we lost the underlying base. And that's coming up again. We support the land use goals that Metro has shepherded through the region. We are perhaps one of the few communities in that region to have all of our comprehensive planning done, all of our periodic review up to date. This isn't a question of trying to sneak stuff through and then do the back work. We are prepared to advance today. We're one of the poorest communities in the Metro region. We have the longest home-to-work commute in the region. We need the employment locally to address those issues. And frankly, we had set this up for the next round. We had won an expansion of industrial acreage, and that got taken away on a 4-3 vote against staff recommendation. And so we were prepared to come in with all of the background issues having been hashed out and very clear. And in this 2007 update, to be ready to argue for our expansion. And now we're looking at, the gentleman said, not simply a two-year delay, but likely a four-year delay. And that's going to cause more businesses that are looking to expand to have to look elsewhere. We're already out of residential acreage. In the last round, we didn't ask for any because we were expecting to come in 2007 to make that case. Three-quarters of the lands we have obtained in the previous expansions are under development now. So we may be the bulk of that 1% that keeps getting talked about of 2002 and 2004 acreages. Everything that's been brought in has been put in development almost immediately in our community. So what we're looking for is, in a sense, an old argument to go back to the issues that were there in the last expansion, now that we have demonstrably made clear our need for it and that the timing is there, that the infrastructure is available. We were relying on that 2007 time frame. And in a sense, the larger issues of what's broken, well, don't really concern us. What's broken is we've got industry leaving now because we don't have enough land. And if we need to be an exception to the broader issue of how this gets resolved, well, so be it. Maybe we can be the one exception in there, but we're looking for relief immediately. While the larger issues that everyone is alluding to do get worked out, please don't tamp us down so bad that we lose the ability to save ourselves. We've done the work. We're a partner in regional development. Fair is fair is kind of what it comes down to for us, and it's critical.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dennis?
Good afternoon. Dennis Mollihill, Washington County.
Chair Dingfelter and committee members. I'll see if I can make this the shortest testimony. Washington County supports 2051. Washington County supports the urban reserves bill that's coming down the pike. They've got to come together. That will allow Metro to come up with appropriate land to develop down the road. I did not hear anything that was said by those that preceded me that Washington County would disagree with. And the last point, and it's a hackneyed metaphor, but appropriate nonetheless, is that the elephant in the room is financing. You can do all the planning, but if you don't have the money for the infrastructure, I think Representative Cannon has already pointed this out, but maybe at a different time here, the committee would like to hear about just how bad it is. I know that you need to move on today, but this is great to talk about the planning, and it's needed, but the money is what's missing. And
when you say money, you're talking about for infrastructure, for planning services. What in particular are you?
Transportation. Mm-hmm. Maybe a quick example, and there may be groans in the room because I've told this story to some of my cohorts, and that's North Bethany was brought in by Metro. 800 acres. It's going to hold about 12,000 people. Transportation on that, we will have the developers and the homeowners pay for the streets, the local streets. County believes that the connector roads need to be something that everybody helps pay for because that's what gives you your traffic flow and movement. $200 million to do two north-south, two east-west. Washington County has $51 million that it has available annually, and that's already dedicated for the next 10 years. If you wanted to load it all onto the house, $45,000 to $55,000 extra on each house. That's the problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thanks.
Thank you.
Marlon, so we're not allowed to ask, huh?
Chair Dingfelter and members of the committee, for the record, I am Harlan Levy, and I will give you the explanation. I was engaged in that ultra-hazardous sport known as tennis, and I managed to pop my ankle and then walked around on it for about a week before mm-hmm. The pain became so excruciating that I went to the doctor today. So she read me the Riot Act and said that I needed to no longer walk around on it, that I needed to have it completely wrapped and ice it and walk around on crutches for the next 4 weeks. Okay. So I learned my lesson.
Well, thanks for being here, and we wish you a speedy recovery.
Thank you. Anyway, I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2051, but with an amendment. I want to thank Mr. Tucker for making the rounds with my two local boards that represent the Portland area. And the amendment that they agreed to support would be a one-time two-year extension, which would then mean reevaluation of the 5 versus 7 years in 2009. Now, I do have a conceptual amendment that would do that. I don't know if you would like me to introduce that, Chair, or wait for LC to do the drafting. But basically what the amendment says is that this, for this go-around, it would not be required to undergo the UGB analysis until 2009, and then after that it would revert back to 5 years. And, of course, we would reevaluate this in the 2009 session and see if 5 versus 7 years was appropriate.
This is just a hearing, not a work session, so
okay.
We won't be moving anything today, but certainly.
Sorry, can I ask Mr. Levy to identify who he represents?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm here representing the Oregon Association of Realtors and the two local boards that have jurisdiction over the Portland area. That's the Portland Metropolitan Association of Realtors and the Commercial Association of Realtors.
Thank you.
And I apologize. I've actually been called to the Revenue Committee, so you're going to continue this hearing. And so we will certainly, I think we have a few more folks that we want to have come up, but I appreciate you offering that amendment. We'll talk about it in a work session.
Okay. Thank you.
Actually, I'll call up the next group, and then I'll have my able vice chair take over. I think, is Kelly Ross here today? I didn't see Kelly. Kelly, you're hiding back there. I think, and then was there anybody, Jim Johnson had signed up originally from the Department of Agriculture, and then Mr. Schellenberg, who I saw come in and out. There you go. John, you want to come up? And then after that, I think we'll ask Metro to come back up to respond to any questions. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Go ahead when you're ready.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kelly Ross, and I'm representing a group of major developers and builders located in the Portland metro area. I'll be very brief, and I just want to focus in on a couple points that were made by Mr. McCauley and Mr. Chandler, specifically the issue of short-term land supply and the prohibition that Metro has on any application, be it from property owners or local governments, to get residential land added to the boundary between reviews. As Mr. McCauley mentioned, that was passed in 2001, and to my knowledge, it represents the only such prohibition by a local government agency in the state. And because of that prohibition of consideration of land between reviews, it focuses much more attention on these five-year reviews and makes them, I believe, more contentious and more magnified than they would be if there could be some consideration between reviews. You heard from the representative from Cornelius, this is a prime example. If there was an allowance for, at the very least, local governments to bring forward these type of land expansions, it would be a wonderful tool and would ultimately make Metro's job at the five-year review a little bit easier to siphon off some of this need. And it is entirely possible that Metro could structure the rules for those kind of applications for a maximum acreage amount per year so they don't get inundated with requests like that. They could lever public benefits out of the development community by saying that the application has to include X amount of open space, X amount of affordable housing, and be readily served by infrastructure with a capital facilities plan. So we would just, my clients would also very much like to work with Metro and this committee on coming up with a system that would allow that to the maximum public benefit. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Don Schellenberg, representing Oregon Farm Bureau. Mr. Kelly was brief. I'm going to be frank. Oregon Farm Bureau members don't believe that there's an automatic right for a city to expand. Our concern, of course, is with the prime farmland. A city surrounded by prime farmland maybe should not expand. What really needs to happen, in our view, is that the expansion of UGBs or the expansion of growth in a county really ought to be directed at the county level rather than on a city-by-city basis. The county can take the broad view and look around and see where it's appropriate for growth to occur within the county. It kind of strikes me in hearing some of the testimony that it sounds like growth is awfully expensive, and I'm wondering maybe why they want to do it. If they can't afford the infrastructure to do it even, why do you keep bringing more land into UGV? On the political side, your comment regarding what would change if this bill weren't to pass, what would that change? It wouldn't, you're right, it wouldn't change a thing. There was a comment that that current decisions are political decisions. Well, I don't know any decision along that line that isn't going to be political. Even if you don't change, that isn't going to make it unpolitical. So Farm Bureau does support House Bill 2051 and would encourage your support as well. Thank you.
Thanks. Other questions for these panelists? Great. Thank you very much.
Anybody else?
Is there anybody else who came here to testify before we get back to Metro? I think Randy Tucker is going to come back up, but is there anyone else who's here to testify today on 2051? All right. Seeing no one. Randy, do you want to come up, and Carl as well? This is an opportunity to maybe answer any of the or address any of the issues that came up during the testimony, as well as for us to ask you any questions that are lingering on our minds. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Randy Tucker, Metro Legislative Affairs Manager. I'm going to let Councillor Hostica lead off or do most of the talking here.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee. My name is Carl Hostica, and I'm a Metro Councillor who represents the people who reside in mostly Washington County and Beaverton to Wilsonville. I'd like to just address a couple of the points. I think what you heard is everybody agrees that the system is broken. And there are various ways we can describe what's broken about the system, but basically the conclusion is that it doesn't work both in terms of bringing land in that is not developed very quickly, but also that doesn't really lead to a comprehensive view that balances the needs of the entire community and provides the kind of metropolitan area which meets the needs of the people in the metropolitan area. So we have imbalance and we have expansions that don't really yield anything. You've heard all of that. I think everybody agrees on the basic direction that we want to move to fix it, but whether or not this bill is an ingredient of that seems to be what's in dispute. I would say that basically this bill isn't going to fix all the problems of the system. We know that. We agree on that. However, without this bill, we won't be able to fix the problems of the system because we'll be back into the immediately flung back into the process of the broken system trying to meet the requirements of a law which nobody that you've heard testify and that I've heard actually supports. So that without the bill, we can't do the fix. The bill itself won't provide the fix. And I think that's the main point at this time to focus on. A couple of things about how we want to do the fix, though, I think are important because the major concern is that the system both requires us to do things in an artificial time horizon and not be able to respond to short-term needs. The fact is that we do have a system where if there is a short-term need for employment land, we can address that. And I think that what you heard is that we don't have a process to address short-term needs in residential land, but the fact is we have 6,000 acres that are inside the urban growth boundary that aren't being developed, so it would be very hard for somebody to make the case that there was such a need. I agree that maybe they ought to be given the opportunity to do that. But the main thing is that the process that we're trying to get to is a process by which we would have designated urban reserves, we would have some pre-planning, we would have identified the money in order to provide the infrastructure so that there were a demonstrated short-term need that we could respond rapidly. Right now, somebody can demonstrate the need, we go through the whole process, we bring it in, and as we know, 5 to 6 years later, the land is there undeveloped. So that I don't think the existing process would allow us to address the needs that people have addressed. The Cornelius situation, I would like to mention a few things as sort of an example of why we have the problems. The basic issue in Cornelius came down to the fact that we don't have a clearly defined idea of the long-term needs of the agriculture in the area and the long-terms of the industrial needs in the area and where those two should be located. And so we were looking piecemeal at one piece after another without a comprehensive view, and a majority of the council decided that they didn't want to go in that direction. It turned out that Cornelius had rezoned some of their industrial land to residential land. And so what we have is a situation where a community changes what's employment land to residential and then comes and asks for more employment land. It causes a certain amount of difficulty, and we are trying to address that issue right now at the regional level with people all working together to say, if a community wants to redesignate it, who has to make it up and how's it made up? So the my basic point at this time is we need this bill in order to do the fixes that everybody wants us to do, and part of that fix is to make us more responsive to short-term needs and to then also have the ability to actually see some effect from the decisions we make. I'd be happy to answer any questions or let Randy fill in where I might have missed something.
Why don't we go ahead to Randy?
Very briefly, Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee. Councillor Hostica covered most of it. I think looking at the specific comments of Mr. Schleter, Mr. McCauley, and Mr. Chandler, they've each made the argument, really, I think, for this bill rather than against it in discussing how difficult it is to address the development of areas that have been brought into the boundary. That's exactly what Metro would like to be able to try to do. That's exactly what Metro did undertake with the adoption of the construction excise tax that was adopted by the council with the support of the home builders and associated general contractors and the realtors and some other Portland Business Alliance and other members of the development community. It's sort of one of these, an elephant is like a tree, an elephant is like a rope, you know, type of things. The other thing is that as Councillor Hostica mentioned, there is a process called the major amendment process that was just instituted or updated since last legislative session, actually in response to another piece of legislation here that had to do with schools, but that also applies to industrial lands. Be glad to provide more detail or bring somebody down that can explain that to you if you're interested. But what it doesn't apply to is residential lands. The council and the land use planning program agree that residential lands should be brought into the urban growth boundary upon a demonstration of need, and the current process is that need is demonstrated through the every 5-year periodic review, that bringing in land in between cycles, at least the council decided several years ago, wasn't something they wanted to do. We can talk about that again if necessary. So the last thing I'll say is, this is a sheet of paper which was distributed in the packet on Friday. Lays out, you know, in just graphic form, obviously, and not in detail, the kind of work that Metro is undertaking over the next several years to try to improve and rationalize this process. And one of the major areas that I think Mr. Schleter alluded to was the trying to figure out, you know, the land that's really good agricultural land is also in some cases good industrial land or good residential land or something else. There's a process has been underway for the last several months in collaboration with the state Department of Land Conservation and Development and Department of Ag, and also with the three counties of the metro region and metro, to try to look actually at those areas around the outside of the metro urban growth boundaries called the Ag Urban Study. If Mr. Johnson from the Department of Ag, who was here on Friday, comes back to testify, he can tell you more about it. But basically, the idea there was to say, let's look realistically and maybe outside the lines of the current land use system and the current laws that apply to us at what we really ought to be doing. What we think is the right thing to do in terms of the protection of agriculture and the protection of natural areas and realistic understanding of what it takes to develop an urban community, and try to change our process so that we can so the rules actually send us in the direction we all agree we need to go. And that's what we're trying to undertake here with this, you know, this very kind of, you know, complicated looking chart, but that's the goal that we're trying to achieve. We can only achieve it if we have a break from the treadmill of the urban growth boundary process.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel? Well, I have one, and it's really just a point of clarification, and that is we heard several people say that if we pass this bill, in fact, we won't begin bringing new land under development for another 4 years. And so, in fact, what this is a 4-year delay. Can you sort of speak to that?
Yeah, it's hard for me to believe that 2 + 0 = 4, but sometimes the math does get away with it in this kind of setting. But what it is if we did, say, amend the urban growth boundary in 2007, the land wouldn't be available till 2009. If we amended in 2009, the land would be available in 2011. So that it's not a, it doesn't take a 2 year and make it a 4 year. It's just the whole process gets moved backwards 2 years.
Thank you, Mary. Do you want to add to that, Randy?
Well, yeah, the statute puts the land, we have to do the analysis, and then after that is the time when you actually bring the land in. Of course, land was brought into the urban growth boundary just in 2005 and in 2004, as well as 2002 as well. So it's not like there's been five full years of no UGB expansions, and now there's going to be four more years of no UGB expansions.
Okay. Thank you. All right.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. All right, so with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on 2051 and open an informational meeting. I'll call Ed Bowles from the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife to testify.
Vice Chair Cannon, members of the committee, my name is Ed Bowles. I'm the Fish Division Administrator for Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. I'm just waiting for the technology to get back up. It went into sleep mode, it looks like. Okay, Ian, is this just hit the on button? The mouse is not engaging it.
It likes to sleep after.
Yes. Vice Chair Cannon, I was asked to provide a briefing on our Coast Cove Conservation Plan, and it's something that the state of Oregon's been working on for quite some time in collaboration with the federal government through NOAA Fisheries, as well as all the Oregon Plan partner agencies for those natural resource agencies. All right, and I'm going to try to breeze through this in the abbreviated version, given the time that you have. We've got two things to cover, really. The ESA listing decision that played out last year, and then the conservation plan itself, which was recently developed and will be adopted by our commission, hopefully in March. And just first going through the status assessment that led to the NOLIS decision by the federal government, this just shows the number of wild fish spawning for this coastal area. And what I want you to focus on is the real downturn in the 1990s. This is what we were most concerned with relative to the status of the fish. And so that's where our assessment focused. And we're somewhat fortunate to be watching the fish and listening to them during this period due to the great monitoring program established through the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds. So we're able to watch how the fish performed going into here, this bottleneck, and how they performed coming out. One of the key drivers during that downturn in the 90s was ocean conditions. And just to be brief on this, anything above the line on this figure represents good ocean conditions. Anything below the line is poor ocean conditions. You'll see in those 90s, it was an unprecedented downturn in ocean conditions for these fish over the past 50 years. That's where we focused our assessment. We were most concerned about how the fish were doing when times were tough for them. We looked at several attributes rather than just one. We looked at their abundance, their survivability or productivity, persistence over time, and then their distribution and diversity, because no one look at the fish gives you a complete picture of how they're doing. And I'm going to, we have a very comprehensive assessment on this. I'm just going to give you the results of that. Coastwide, this is all the way from Astoria, basically down to Cape Blanco, split into five big strata. We've got the mainly north tier strata that passed, and then a couple in the south that passed with flying colors. Within each of those, we have populations, and there's 21 different populations. Those in the red represent those that did fail our criteria. And so each of the strata have some populations that failed, and those will be a focus of the recovery actions that we're taking. But overall, each of these strata were viable and moving forward. The conclusions we had were that the overall grouping of populations for coastal coho, that they are viable, that management has been effective, that ocean conditions and overwinter habitat for the juvenile fish moving out towards the ocean was the main thing limiting their production, and that we have a very good monitoring program that provides that feedback mechanism where we can adjust programs as we move forward to make sure we're doing what's best for the fish. I'd like to mention that this information that we provided to the federal national, well, NOAA Fisheries, which is the group, the federal body that makes the decision on the listing, and then they decided not to list these fish, coastal coho, and that is being litigated at this time, and I can fill you in more on that if you're interested. But we're moving forward now with a state conservation plan where the federal government has worked with us collaboratively to develop this. And it is a requirement of our native fish conservation policy to move beyond just the viability assessment. Very rigorous public process over 2 years, 21 members, over 20 meetings coastwide, including town hall meetings after this, and a lot of public comments and commission meetings within our Fish and Wildlife Commission. That's probably not a good thing, Ian.
We do have your handout here.
But I'll just keep moving forward. Yeah. I'd like to tell you, as far as the conservation plan, part of our focus there was to really look at what were the real limiting factors that were ailing the fish, and go beyond just where we found them at the current status. And if you'll remember when I showed that figure of how they were doing right now, they really weren't collectively firing on all cylinders. And so there is a lot of room for improvement, even though they're viable and not needing protection under the federal ESA. The Oregon plan requires that they move forward beyond that. And so we have established a kind of a desired status for these fish that basically double the numbers of fish at low marine survival. And so basically where we averaged 50,000 fish during that downturn in ocean conditions in the 1990s, we would now in the future, if we saw that again, wouldn't drop below 100,000 as an average. And even more remarkably, with the current the desired status, if we had what we had at the turn of the century, we'd be up around 800,000, pushing a million fish spawning in the wild. Very remarkable and very ambitious for a conservation plan to actually reach that far. The stakeholders, representing a very broad and diverse group, were comfortable with this ambitious objective. And then the next step is to say, okay, what is ailing the fish, keeping them from reaching this objective, and what can we do about it? What are the actions that we can implement in order to get there? And that's the basic foundation of the plan. And so within those actions, we've looked at the number of things that are across the board needed to be addressed. And if within habitat, one of the key areas is this habitat for the juvenile coho that first winter before they hit the ocean, and trying to reestablish what we call complexity in the channel, which is kind of large wood in there, as well as alcoves and little areas to slow the water down to provide them cover and protection. And so we're going to focus on that from the habitat standpoint. We're doing it in a non-regulatory fashion. We have an existing regulatory backdrop, which the Oregon plan embraces, implemented by all the state agencies under federal guidelines for some of them. That existing regulatory structure would move forward, and then we'd focus on voluntary actions in the spirit of the Oregon plan to get these projects on the ground, focusing on the factors that are actually limiting the fish for each individual population. And we have the benefit through the Oregon plan of having an infrastructure to implement these projects on the ground and custom tailor the projects to fit the individual characteristics of the watersheds, whether you know, regardless of what the limiting factors are. We'll be moving forward on harvest actions, primarily embracing what we've already done. You'll see from one of those slides that we've reduced harvest on wild fish dramatically since the 1980s. And we will continue that structure that allows us to protect the wild fish and focusing on selective fisheries for the hatchery fish. And then as the populations rebuild, actually implementing wild fisheries, which we've already done on a couple of the productive lakes systems within the coast. As far as hatcheries, there's been very little change there. Most of the dramatic changes to hatcheries occurred early on in the Oregon Plan implementation, so there's very little changes right now that we're proposing. But there is a reduction, a net reduction of about 60,000 hatchery smolts that will be less than what was occurring before due to this plan. And those are specifically to address limiting factors for populations in the Salmon River and the North Fork of the Umpqua. But the effect on the ocean fisheries will be not really detectable. We have over 14 million hatchery fish out in the ocean for folks to fish on that come primarily out of the Columbia River system that turns south. As far as the governance side of this, I want to emphasize that our primary approach is going to be to continue through the Oregon Plan with a bottom-up approach of implementing things on the ground through the watershed councils, the soil and water conservation districts, other entities that really provide a custom-tailored local ownership to get these on the ground. And then a top-down oversight approach through the core team of the Oregon Plan, which has been rechartered in order to emphasize the needs of these conservation plans and their implementation. So we have a letter which was handed out to you from the governor emphasizing this approach and encouraging each of the partner agencies within the Oregon Plan to step up and do their part in order to implement the conservation plan. Within my agency, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, which is a commission-directed agency, our commission will be making a decision on implementing their components of this on March 16th at their next commission meeting, and we will codify those elements into rule. I think I'll stop there, Vice Chair Cannon, and answer any questions if you have any, and also encourage you, if you are interested, to go ahead and visit the draft document, which is on the Oregon Plan website, as well as you can link it through our website, and it's got all the details, as well as a facilitator's report that covered the stakeholder process, which includes details of how the dynamic played out, and by no means was this a strong sort of consensus process. Lots of strong feelings on both sides of this, fairly represented in the process. We feel very comfortable with the plan as it's moving forward and very comfortable with the approach and the science that's behind it. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. Bowles? None? All right. Well, as I hand the gavel back to the chair, I'll thank you for and the department for the work in bringing this plan forward.
Thank you, Ed. Sorry, I know I've seen it several times before, but I know I'd enjoy it again, so I apologize for missing the presentation. So you solved all, I heard you solved
yeah,
all
the problems. Yeah, we took care of everything.
Okay, thank you. So I guess, do I need to close that informational meeting or just
continue? No, we're moving
continue?
On to
okay, so,
second speakers.
We are now going to hear from Michael Campagna and is Todd here?
Todd's
okay,
not here.
I didn't see him. From the Oregon State University Institute for Water and Watersheds, and I think they have a PowerPoint presentation. Thank you for taking over. Just if the committee was wondering, the biofuels bill was up in revenue and it passed the -7 amendments passed unanimously out of the committee. So it's now going to the House floor. Thank you, Michael, for
You're
being here.
Welcome.
Appreciate it.
Not a problem.
Is it a holiday for you?
No, I haven't had a holiday. It's like it's not a holiday for you either. So it's not a problem. So.
And maybe you can also provide a brief background on for folks who aren't familiar with the Institute. Actually, you can give it to Ian. He'll pass them out. And can you, for the record, state your name and then just so folks who aren't familiar with the Institute and what they do.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Michael Campana, and I am the director of the, let me see, I'll bring this up here. That's right. I need a PowerPoint to tell me what I do. Okay. I'm the director of the Institute for Water and Watersheds at Oregon State University, which is a relatively new organization at OSU. Oops. There we go. Okay. And what the Institute does is it's an umbrella organization, a campus-wide organization that is to serve as a focal point for water research, teaching, and outreach at Oregon State University. And so I don't have a dean to report to, although I do have a vice president. And so I also have an appointment in the Department of Geosciences at Oregon State. So anyway, I'm really happy to be here, my first time in the state capitol, first time before a state committee. I hope it won't be the last. I saw Vice Chair Cannon smiling at the quote down there on the bottom. I usually the meek shall inherit the earth, but not its water rights. Which J. Paul Getty originally the quote was mineral rights, but in light of this session, I think we'll do with water rights. Now, as an academic, I'm not used to sitting down and giving a PowerPoint, but I realize you're taping this, and so usually I wave my arms about, so you're going to have to bear with me here. I'll be turning my head, and I've got my little laser pointer, which they let me bring into the building. That was a nice surprise. First, a little bit of organization. I'll go into a couple of quotes about measurement and data, and remember, when we talk about measurement, we're really talking about acquiring data. Okay, so the two are very closely related, obviously. The second thing I wanted to mention was I was in our nation's capital last week, and Bob Hirsch, who's the associate director of the U.S. Geological Survey, in charge of water, talked about his big four water issues, and all of them are extremely relevant to us here in Oregon. So I thought I'd lay them out for you. Then I want to talk about why do we need water measurements, give some examples. Water measurement programs have generally fallen on hard times, both at the state level and the federal level. I want to finish up with the USGS National Water Use Information Program, and then actually really finish up with Oregon. Okay. A couple of quotes. The first one is a very long-winded quote from a very famous 19th century physicist, Lord Kelvin, also known as William Chambers, but they liked to pick fancy names for themselves in those days. And the actual quote goes on and on and on. And even the part that I put up there, really you can sum it in just those five words. To measure is to know. If you know what you're measuring, then you have some knowledge of it. And if you don't know, if you can't measure things, then Lord Kelvin really didn't want to talk to you. And actually, that's what he says in the second part of the quote. It's like, don't bother me. The next one is from Einstein, or at least it's attributed to Einstein, although it's really not clear. Not everything that can be counted counts, and not everything that counts can be counted. Now, I know this sounds like something that you'd hear on, Jon Stewart or The Daily Show or something like that, but it actually kind of, it makes a lot of sense, because some things that you can measure or count really don't matter very much. And then there's some things that matter, but you can't measure them. And I think a good example of the latter part of the quote are some of the issues we face with some contaminants, some things that we didn't even think about years ago and now are health threats, things like MTBE, the pharmaceuticals that we find in our waterways. You know, we weren't worried about those things, but they were there. Okay, and the last one is a quote from a report that I'll talk about later on in the talk, essentially saying that the collection of water use data is really getting it's getting the shaft, if you will, short shrift or the shaft, and essentially the funding support for data collection programs, especially in water, are actually drying up, and I'll talk a little bit about that in a second. Now, Bob Hirsch, U.S. Geological Survey. Bob is a very astute observer of the water scene. In fact, he's almost as old as I am. He's been in this business a long time, but he's a lot more famous than I am. So anyway, these are the four issues that he identified as being really big. And the next slide will get into why he came up with these. The first one, and these are in no order, except I would argue that given the time that he spent on the first issue, that was the most important to him. And that's in-stream flows, ecological or environmental flows. And he actually, that second part there, the gridlock issue, that's what he said. That's not my addition. He said that is going to be or is the gridlock issue when it comes to water. And I think I don't have to tell anybody in this room that in Oregon and the Pacific Northwest, this is a big issue. The next one are groundwater-surface water interactions and a closely related issue, sustainability. And this may sound kind of funny, but you know, in the past 10 years or so, a lot of people have become aware that, you know, groundwater and surface water actually are connected. Now, again, up here in the Pacific Northwest and Oregon, you know, we've known that for a while, but in some other places, it's like, hey, that's really something. We mess around with the groundwater, we're going to affect the surface water and vice versa. The third one, and again, a very important one, is the incorporation of climate change into water resources planning. I was just up in Portland a couple weeks ago speaking before the Regional Water Providers Consortium talking about climate change and water resources, and this is a big issue everywhere. And the last one he mentioned is what he calls fixing, and again, that is his word, fixing impaired waterways. Okay, so we know we've made a mess of some things, and now we've got to fix them up. And it's not always clear about how we should fix them up. The science is a little bit hazy or fuzzy. Now, he was very honest. He said, now, what motivated me to think about these four great issues? And what motivated him was he was testifying before Congress about the U.S. Geological Survey budget, and a 20-something staffer, and I don't mean to impugn 20-somethings if there are any in the room or on the committee, okay?
There are not.
But, you know, asked a very simple question. You know, looked at Bob with his 30 years' experience and said, hey, you guys have been studying water for over 100 years. Now, haven't you answered all the questions? Essentially saying, why do you need this, you know, $800 or $900 million budget? And I'm sure Bob gave him a very astute, erudite answer. But he went home that night and he said, you know, I have to, those are the kind of questions that you know, you need to think about. They're kind of embarrassing. Okay, now let's look at data requirements for some of these big four water issues. And I just have a little shopping list here. But if you're looking at in-stream flows, and I'll illustrate these a little bit later with some pretty pictures. But you need a lot of information, a stream hydrograph. You also need a number of ecological measurements, which we hydrologists are not familiar with. We actually need to interact with aquatic ecologists and fisheries biologists to get at these things. And, of course, water quality. Groundwater, surface water interactions, whole suite of measurements there. Climate change, this is a little bit tricky because we haven't really dealt with climate change, okay? So we say, you know, what are the important things to measure, okay? And then, of course, fixing impaired waterways, water quality. And the last thing I mentioned right down there in the bottom are emerging contaminants. And these are the things that we need to be able to try to look 20 or 30 years ahead and figure out what's in the system now that we're not measuring, bless you, but that may be a real problem in 20 or 30 years. That wasn't in there, was it? No, bless you. Okay. Now, why do we need water measurements? Okay, and this is my own little shopping list, not from Bob Hirsch. The first thing is to provide data. Okay, hydrologists, geologists, biologists, we all want to see data. Okay, we need data to put into our models, to tell regulators whether things are working or not. We also want to know how much water we have and how good its quality is so that we can plan, but we also want to know so we can keep others from taking the water or polluting the water. Now that may sound like a very crass thing to say, but it's true. If you don't know how much water you have or what the quality is, then if someone comes along and tries to take your water, when I say someone, I mean maybe another someone else who has another water right, or perhaps another state or a county or something like that, you need to know that. Okay, and my experience in the Southwest, where everybody is trying to take everybody else's water, prompted me to put that thing in there. Okay. Now, I realize up here in the Northwest, people are more civil. We don't have issues like that, okay?
I was going to say, I don't think you've been in the Northwest that long.
I've been in the sun too long. Yes, yeah. I know. Okay. We also want to manage the resource wisely. We want to be able to assess changes, and this is very important with respect to things like climate change, okay? If we don't know what the baseline is, how are we going to know whether the climate is going to be influencing, say, the water resource systems? We also want to collect data and make measurements so we can enforce regulations and determine whether they're effective or not. And another important issue is we want to be able to assess cause and effect relationships. And this simply means that if I'm interested in water quality, if I put a landfill over here, is it going to affect the water quality over there? I need to collect data to be able to do that. Now,
Michael, I just wanted to let you know, these mics are really sensitive, so you actually would be better to push it back just a little bit because you're coming in a little fuzzy.
Fuzzy,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, you don't have to be right up to the mic. They're super sensitive.
Okay.
So it gives you a little more
flexibility. Thank you, Madam Chair. I've never been accused of fuzzy in my life. So anyway, I just put this up here. This is an example of a stream flow hydrograph. It's simply a plot of the stream discharge on the y-axis, and then this is over a 12-month period on the x-axis. Now, this is actually from a report that Rick Palmer did for the city of Portland, but I'm just using it as an example because if you're interested in in-stream flows, what's really important is you want to get the whole hydrograph. You just don't want to get isolated points. But if you're concerned about whether the fish or whatever have enough water to survive, you need to see the whole picture. And it took us a while to realize that. This is a familiar picture of the hydrologic cycle. Actually, it's not too familiar to the Northwest. This is from Bob Glennon, who's in Arizona, and that's why the sun is here. Okay. But this just shows a generic, you know, we all, precipitation, snow melt, infiltration, all these things here need to be measured. Okay, stream flow, evaporation, evapotranspiration, infiltration. We've got a lot of information, a lot of data to acquire when we're dealing with water resource systems. And you'll notice that there's really no indication of water quality here. It's all flows, discharge, and things like that. And so if you factor in the water quality, then that's a real, you're talking about a lot of information. Here's another example, or this one in particular, groundwater surface water interactions. Okay, and sometimes the water, groundwater flows to the stream, other times it flows in the opposite direction. And what may happen is you may be interested in how the quality of the stream will be impacted by the groundwater or vice versa, or whether you're pumping, as in this case, is extracting water for the stream, in which case you might run into some water rights issues. Or you might run into some water quality issues. If the water quality in the stream is bad and you start sucking it out of your well. Anyway, I put these up here simply to indicate that all these things, you need, if you want to understand these systems, you need data, so you got to do measurements. Now, why have we fallen on hard times? Well, I mean, there's just a general reduction in funding for a lot of things, okay? So I'm not singling out water measurement programs as the only things that are suffering. But let me go through some common reasons why these programs suffer. There's a perception among funders, people who provide the money, that collecting data is not like real work. It's just you kind of, you know, it's an excuse to get in your truck, your four-wheel drive, and go out to a well or something. And I've actually had people tell me that. That's, you know, you should be in front of your computer like I am now, okay? And some people feel the other way. The second bullet, and this is probably one of the most common things, is that people say, well, what are you doing with the data that you're collecting? You're making all these measurements. Are you doing anything with it? And there have actually been some government programs at the federal level where people have been collecting data for, you know, 30, 40, or 50 years, and yet not much has come out of it in terms of our understanding of how systems work. And so in some cases, this is a valid complaint. Others will say, look, you don't really have a plan or a scheme. Why are you continuing to collect this information or make these measurements? You know, is it because you can or you always have? I mean, why are you really doing this? Do you have a plan? And so the bottom bullet is simply a statement of fact. And again, this is from Bob Hirsch. The U.S. Geological Survey each year, for the past several years, I think he said five to be exact, has been losing about 130 stream gauging stations each year. Okay? So these are streams that we could actually, that diagram I put up from Rick Palmer, we're losing that information. And some of these gauging stations have as much as 90 years of record. So a very long period of record. Now, this is not due solely to reductions in the USGS's budget, but a lot of these stations are operated with cooperators, oftentimes state governments, county governments, or other federal agencies. And so in some cases, it's the other agency's budget is being cut, but the USGS does not have sufficient funds to maintain the station, so they have to take it out of service. And, of course, once you take it out of service, you don't lose that information, but you lose an awful lot. And the important aspect of that is, especially with climate change, we have to be able to assess how climate change is going to affect our water resources. And one of the things that we're going to have is a lot of baseline information. We're going to need stream flow records from 50, 60, 70, 80, or 90 years ago. We're going to need water levels. We're going to need a lot of information, because otherwise it won't be clear to us whether we're seeing an effect or how soon we're seeing an effect with respect to climate change. And I'll just point out that the National Water Quality Assessment Program, the NAQUA program, which is active here in Oregon, again, the U.S. Geological Survey, this program was designed in response to a specific congressional inquiry that was made in the mid-1980s by Representative Sid Yates, who was then Representative Congressman from Illinois. He actually asked the USGS, look, we've had the Clean Water Act for about 10 or 12 years. Is it having any effect? And Phil Cohen of the USGS was very embarrassed because he couldn't answer the question. Here you had the premier water agency of the federal government, and he couldn't answer a simple question like, are our waters getting better? And so Yates didn't castigate him, but essentially said, you know, you guys need to come up with the program so that the next time I ask this, I can get an answer from you. And so they did. And so this is essentially looking at, is the Clean Water Act working? Now, the last thing, I'm getting near the end here, there's a program that many people don't know about called the USGS National Water Use Information Program. It has a horrible acronym, won't bother to try to pronounce it, NUOP something. Anyway, what they do is every 5 years they publish a little circular called Estimated Use of Water in the United States in such and such a year, and I have this one. This is the 1995 issue. And it's really just a compendium of the water use in the United States by state for a variety of uses. How much water is used for power generation, how much water is used for municipal, industrial, etc. Now, about 3 or 4 years ago, I was on a committee to evaluate this water use program. And at the time I was appointed to the committee, it was we didn't know we were going to be doing this program. And most of us on the committee kind of groaned, like, you want us to do water use? I mean, that's just bookkeeping, you know? Well, it turns out we really got into it and actually found out what an amazing wealth of information there is out there. And what we recommended to the U.S. Geological Survey hierarchy is, first of all, the program is very poorly funded. It really is a stepchild. It relies on voluntary submission of data by state. So the USGS did not personally collect everything in here. They would ask each of the 50 states, hey, could we have your information? Now, some states were very forthcoming. Some states would, not really interested in giving you much information unless we have to. And one of the amazing things we found out, and again, I don't mean to impugn anybody here, but the best state in the union by far in terms of collecting data and making it accessible, it's actually on the web, was Arkansas. And it's the Arkansas Soil and Water Conservation Commission, which I now believe is subsumed within the Natural Resources Commission. They had the best program for acquiring surface water and groundwater data and making it accessible. And they worked with the state office of the USGS in doing this. Okay, it's actually, I tried to log on this morning, but it crashed. So I guess they still have some work to do. Okay. What we recommended, though, is, and when I'm talking about water use here, water use is a very important component of water resources. How are we using water? Okay. But we recommended that water use be taken out of the realm of, you know, as I did when I first learned about it, you know, rolling your eyes saying, oh, that's just, you know, collecting shells or something. It's actually a science. It should be a science. They're very sophisticated methods, statistical methods you can use to analyze and collect data. And the program wasn't doing that. And so we advocated using statistical sampling techniques where appropriate. Another important aspect is to evaluate uncertainties. How good are your data? Okay, we knew that if they were from Arkansas, they were pretty good. But if they were from West Virginia, they weren't good because West Virginia has no data requirements. They'll just take whatever you give them. We encourage that they develop methods to measure in-stream flows for ecological uses. And again, this is very important up here. And what we're saying is a certain amount of water in the stream is used for ecological uses. How much? Most people can't answer that. When I say most people, I mean aquatic ecologists. They really can't give you a good answer. The other one is, the recommendation is, we wanted the program to expand itself to include water quality and the effects of land use. And this was the link to the National Water Quality Program, which tries to link water use, water quality, and land use. And those three things, in my mind, are inseparable, and most places don't really do a good job in linking those three together. The last one is kind of a very arcane recommendation using a particular model called the Sparrow model, which has how they got that acronym out of there. And again, I won't even read what it actually stands for, but it's essentially a sophisticated statistical model that links stream water quality, water use, and land use. And the USGS developed it about 10 years ago, and they've been very successful in using it. Now, the last thing I'll mention is, how does this relate to Oregon? Okay. First of all, if you're talking about measurement, it really depends, again, on what are you looking at or what are you looking for. And so it's difficult to say a certain measurement approach should be used for all kinds of data. We have water use data. We have water quality data. We have diversions, precipitation, all kinds of things. But one of the things that and again, some of these may be in use now. I'm just kind of pulling these out of the air. If you're looking at gross information, for example, you want to know what the water use is in Oregon or the water use is in Multnomah County or something, you can probably use statistical approaches which require a lot of information and you can get some valid numbers out of that. However, if you're looking at regulation or enforcement information, you're trying to find out whether standards are being exceeded or someone is diverting too much water, then you're going to need individual data points. You're going to need well water levels. You're going to need pumping rates, stream discharge, diversions, water quality measurements. Looking at gross numbers is not going to help you out very much. Okay. You also need data for models so that predictions can be made, and this is very important within the realm of climate change. And those aren't the only places we use models, but the models for climate change are getting to the point now where we can actually use them as coupling them with hydrologic models to make predictions about what's going to happen in the future. And that's what Rick Palmer and his colleagues at the University of Washington did for the city of Portland. The other thing that you also need is ancillary data. And sometimes this isn't really apparent. What's the additional data you need? For example, if you're really interested in water quality, if you're interested in water use, it's hard to separate land use from these things. Land use influences water use, and it influences water quality. And so if you really want to get a good picture of cause and effect relationships, then you're going to need all three. You're going to need water use, which is water quantity data. You're going to need water quality data, and you're going to need land use data. And with that, these are the references I've cited in case any of you want to pursue this. Palmer's is actually online. You can get it from that URL. It's a very interesting report about the what Portland may face in the future with respect to climate change. And so with that, I will be glad to answer any questions, Madam Chair.
Great. Thank you so much for being here today. We appreciate it. And thank you for that excellent overview presentation. See if any of the committee members have questions for the professor.
Okay, great.
All right.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
And I think last up we have the Water Resources Department. I guess you have both Gary Norris and Debbie Colbert. And we've got about 15 minutes because we need to leave here by 5:02. I want to leave a few minutes for questions as well. Sorry. Madam Chair, while Barry is getting the PowerPoint queued up, I guess I'll just, for the record, I'm Debbie Colbert with the Water Resources Department, and with me today is Barry Norris. He's our state engineer, and he also is the administrator of our technical services division at the Water Resources Department. We are going to quickly run through a couple things with you today. We're going to talk about kind of what are we doing in Oregon to measure water. What are some areas where we have some pretty strategic coordinated networks around the state? Where are some places that we might think about enhanced measurement for the future? So with that, I'll pass it off to Barry Norris.
Thank you, Debbie. I'm Barry Norris, administrator of our Technical Services Division. We consider the measuring water in Oregon as a cornerstone for our comprehensive water resource management. We use the data for allocating water supplies and regulation, distribution, monitoring in-stream flows, early warning systems for drought and flood forecasting, evaluation of long-term trends, and just a whole host of different applications. You heard some of them with the previous speaker, and I could go on and on about that, but I agree with him. The way you manage something is having ability to measure it. We categorize our measurement data that we collect into kind of three general categories. One would be we collect it in units of discharge or cubic feet per second. This is a picture of an individual doing a current or a discharge measurement using a current meter. He's measuring the velocity, cross-sectional area of the water, so he can come up with CFS, how much water is passing that point. We also can use staff gauges if we have a rating for a section. And we do this type of method up and down a streamway to do seepage runs so that we can determine the interaction between surface water and groundwater. Where you have a gaining reach, of course, groundwater is contributing. Where you have a losing reach, why groundwater surface water is discharging into the ground. We also measure water in terms of volume, calling with acre feet, that is an acre of land covered by a foot of water. That's an acre foot of water, and we use that for defining the capacity in a reservoir. Water rights are also, irrigation rights are also defined by both the rate, the amount of CFS they can divert at one time, and also by a total volume of water through the irrigation season in acre feet. And then we also measure water, groundwater, in terms of feet below land surface using well tapes, and we lower them down to the surface of the groundwater and collect data on a periodic basis so that we can determine the health of our groundwater aquifers. Diversions, use of water outside a stream bed, can range in size from the upper right, which is the Owyhee Dam, 417 feet in height, storing 715,000 acre-feet of water, all the way down to the lower left-hand corner, which is just a small pump along a waterway that may be diverting 10 gallons, 5 gallons a minute through a 1-inch or an inch and a half or 2-inch pipe. So there's a whole range in sizes for diversions. Types of diversions can be the types of dams up in the upper left where they fold down during the winter season and then you tilt them back up and prop them with a rod through the irrigation season. They're notches for fish passage. Down the lower left is a type of a structure that's made out of concrete, probably or much more elaborate, or does have a fish ladder. And so you can have all types of configurations for out-of-stream diversions. In Oregon, we have, on the bottom left of that chart, 122,562 points of diversions. That includes groundwater, surface water, and storage projects. That does not include the types of diversions that don't require applications or the exempt uses. But out of those, you can see there are just under 8,000 of those we require to have measuring devices. Over on the far right, you can see we require by permit condition 2,842 of them, which are wells, to measure a groundwater level below land surface. In addition to that, or I should say, that represents about 7%. The number that are required to measure represents about 7% of the total number of diversions, but also represents approximately 46% of the water that's diverted. So from that you understand that we require measurement on the larger diversions typically around the state. In addition to these diversions, there are 735 public entities that are required to report annually to the Department on Water Use, and they represent, they're public entities, and they represent a multitude of points of diversions and wells. So in other words, like a municipality may have 3 or 4 or 6 or 10 wells counting as one public entity.
Barry, I'm going to interrupt you for a minute when we're at the slide. Can you explain for the committee the difference between required to record water use and required to report water use, and how those permit conditions would be, why they would be different?
Yes, Madam Chair. The difference is that they're required to record, so they have the information available should we ask for it. And the ones that are required to report have the information, and then they also are required to send that in. The difference is only due to the fact that during the public interest review of those applications, it was determined that we didn't necessarily need that information to be reported every year, but we wanted it out there. We wanted them to report it in case we were to ask for it.
Madam Chair, can I ask a quick question as well? So all diversions in the state, except those that are exempt, operate under a permit that limits the amount of the diversion. How do you ensure compliance? I mean, not getting out to the whole enforcement thing, but if they're not being measured, how do we know that they're in compliance with their permit?
Representative, go ahead.
Madam Chair, Representative, well, you know, in addition to these reporting requirements and measurement requirements, we also have our core water master group that's out there and visiting these areas and checking diversions and current use. So it's kind of the second part of the equation.
Just for clarification, the water master, would they check every diversion, I mean, during a season, or did he do a sort of random sampling, or I've worked with water masters in the past, and, you know, just for committee members to understand, they probably wouldn't visit every single diversion every season because that would be a huge amount. Correct?
Madam Chair, that is correct. Generally, they're responding to complaints from other water users, so they'll go out and they'll check what maybe junior water rights are taking on the stream and make sure they're within the limits of their rights, and then cut them back according to kind of the flows that are available for the seniors. They also, under our Oregon Plan efforts, we make it a high priority to be out measuring for in-stream water rights as well, and basically the amount of water that's in-stream to meet those rights according to priority dates. So certainly we don't visit every diversion, but this is kind of the priority areas that we work.
Thank you.
So to continue, in addition to those points of diversions, the ones we require measurement, our department operates 210 stream gauges statewide. These gauges record stream water levels every 15 minutes. 94 of those stream gauges have telemetry, so they transmit the data either on phone lines, either landlines or cell phones, or through satellite telemetry. I just want to tell you, though, that data that comes through on telemetry is second source. There is not our primary source for the data. We use that as second source data. The primary source are data modules. These gauges need maintenance on the average of once every 6 weeks. Somebody has to go out and maintain the rating curve and collect the data through the data modules. But the telemetry is very helpful in terms of water management to find out what's going on a near real-time basis. This is a map showing where our current 210 active gauge network, where those gauges are. We can offload of the 94 telemetered stations. Most of them, as I said, are satellite. We recently developed a process whereby we can access a national database center called Wallops Island on the East Coast, and we can download the data from the satellites, and then we access that and load it into our system here in Salem. This slide gives you an indication of the number of gauging stations we have operated over the years in Oregon. At one time, during the 70s and early 80s, we actually funded 100 gauges with the USGS in addition to the ones that we operated. Today, only three of them. We only have three, and those are operated with other funds we collect from interested parties outside the agency. We had the funding for the 100 stations, and that went away during the 80s. Nationally, the cost with the USGS, they share operation of the gauge on a two-thirds. They pay for one-third of the operation. We also have a number of other cooperative programs with them, including what was referred to in the previous presentation, the estimated use. We have a cooperative agreement whereby we supply information from on use to the USGS. They collect funding through their budget process, and then they're able to help process Oregon use data.
So this doesn't include USGS gauging stations?
That's correct. These are the gauges that we have operated over the years.
So if you were going to include the USGS gauging stations, would that be about twice as much, or how many do they currently operate in Oregon?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure how many they do operate in Oregon. I think around 100 or so, but I could be off on that. It was the last time I looked.
Well, I know their budget is going down. So
yes, it is.
So I'm curious.
So it would be an increase to this map that shows active gauges.
Madam Chair, we have some additional slides that kind of highlight some of our coordinated kind of partnerships that we've done around the state and some areas we think might kind of benefit from increased measurement, but I know that you're on a strict timeline. Would you like for us to stop here and
keep going? We have until 5:02, so we'll go as far as we can, and then we can continue on Wednesday if we need to.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, in addition to the surface water gauges around the state, we also, on a frequency over the last 2 years, we have a well net of 743 wells. Additionally, on our groundwater investigations and other measurements that we'll make miscellaneous measurements at thousands of wells around the state that where we gain additional information.
We wanted to just quickly run through some highlights of how we've used technology to make it more efficient for us to collect and maintain this kind of data.
On the left is an A35 recorder that's built here in Oregon and used for most of the 19th century and up just until recently. In fact, it's probably still being used at a lot of locations. We have, during the 80s, we migrated over to electronic recorders, and the accuracy and the technology in the electronic recorders has, of course, improved tremendously over the last decade. This is a modern type of recorder where it's got a modem that processes the data either through telemetry to a satellite system or a telephone system. The recorder and a bubbler or pressure transducer system. While these recorders operated on a weight system, a float system that hung in a well and were subject to mechanical failure because of freezes, the float could hang up. A lot of moving parts in these, so oftentimes we had data missing. This has gone to a bubbler or pressure transducer system where it operates on the pressure of the water, the head of the water that's above the transducer. Less moving parts. They're much more reliable, and so we actually get more accurate data, not because of the way we collect it, but because of the technology that's involved. This is the type of current meter, the old AA current meter that is still in use quite a bit, used most of the last century, or we'll use over the last century, and still in use today. With a vane where it orients itself toward the direction of flow in the river, and spoons or impellers that measure the velocity of the water, the operator would stand downstream and just over from the holding this weighting rod and count the number of revolutions that this would spin, and it would relate to the velocity of the water. We've moved over fairly recently to an acoustic meter that does it with sound waves. And so while the process is still the same, 25 measurements per stream channel to get one at each of 25 cross sections, measure it over a minute so that you get compensate for the pulsating effect in the river or stream. So it takes the same amount of time, but there are less moving parts. Thereby, it's more accurate, easier to use, and really improves our ability to measure water. This is a process that we've been using for years to measure high flows or streams where you can't wade. And people would get in these cable cars, sometimes two at once, in high flows where it took
two people to do it, and they would winch themselves across 25 sections again, two measurements per section at 2/10 and 8/10 below the surface of the water, and over a minute for each measurement, using a weight and, again, a double-A meter. And the size of the weight would depend on the velocity of the water. You'd have to get a pretty stout weight during periods of high flow. They'd winch these down and measure the flow. And today, we're able to, again, use these acoustic velocity meters. That this one's mounted on a pontoon. We stretch a rope across to get to get orientation, and then one operator on each side that pull this pontoon across. What's nice about these is that not only they measure velocity, but they also measure a profile, and you get a cross-section of the stream as well, and then get an immediate printout of or understanding of what the flow rate is through that section. The problem with them is they don't operate very well where you have a moving bed or a very rocky bed, and you get false readings. So you have to be careful how you use them.
Gary, I think we're going to stop here and see if there's any questions, because we may have to ask you to come back on Wednesday and finish the presentation. I there's a lot of information here. I don't want to have you rush through. But I want to stop there and see if there are any questions up until now for Gary. Okay. Well, I really appreciate you being here. Are you able to come back on Wednesday? And
absolutely.
Okay. Mainly because we have to be out of this room in about 2 minutes, and there's a lot of information here I want to make sure that we cover, and hopefully we'll have the rest of our committee members here as well for that. So really appreciate it. I was going to say that those pontoons don't look nearly as fun as going out in the old pulleys, which I've done in the past and are a lot more fun, but I think the information is a lot more accurate. I do have one quick question, though. As far as real-time data, so you're saying that you have, if I recall, about 93 of your data measurement is actually real time, so that's available on your website if committee members wanted to see how that is displayed.
Madam Chair, those are we have links to those sites, and we can see what's going on.
Okay. And if you can provide where that information is, so if any of the committee members were interested in seeing what real time data, which is great fun, especially during floods, if you like to track that. I did watch the Wilson River as it crested a few months ago. During that incredible high rain period, it was pretty amazing to watch that as it was happening.
Madam Chair, we'll be happy to get some follow-up information about those links.
Okay, great. So thank you so much. With that, I'm going to close the informational hearing in the House Energy Environment Committee and apologize.